Hello everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel talk show on myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. This is Cure Panel's 53rd episode, and on our monthly myeloma broadcast today, we are discussing progress in high-risk multiple myeloma survival. My co-host for the show today is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are Cure panelists Jack Aiello, Nick Van Dyke, Pat Killingsworth, Lizzie Smith, and Misty Callahan. We have a very eminent and world-renowned expert with us today, Dr. Rafael Fonseca. I welcome everyone to the show. Before I hand over to Gary to introduce the expert and begin with the show, I would like to mention to the audience that if you have a question for Dr. Fonseca, please press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you live on air to ask your question. Gary will now introduce us to our expert. Gary, you're on air.
Why, thank you so much, Priya, and thank you again, as always, to provide this forum for all of the myeloma patients in the myeloma patient community. I now have the honor to introduce you to one of the members of what I consider a myeloma dream team. I personally believe that no other organization has put together the absolute talent and skill of the multiple myeloma specialists of the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Fonseca is currently Deputy Director, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, Getz Family Professor of Cancer, and the Professor of Medicine at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, as well as the Site Director for Hematology Malignancies at Mayo Clinic Scottsdale, Arizona. Dr. Fonseca is a fellow of the International Society of Hematology and is board certified in internal medicine, medical oncology, and hematology. In addition, he holds professional membership in a number of organizations and has been reviewed and a reviewer in many and numerous journals. So that was the Cliff Notes version of Dr. Fonseca's background. Doctor, welcome to Cure Panel.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you, Gary and Priya. It's a pleasure to be with you here today. I know we have a program where I will make some introductory comments talking in regards to what risk means in a patient who's diagnosed with multiple myeloma. Then we'll have the panel session with questions to be addressed. I have a personal interest in the study of myeloma biology with an emphasis on the understanding of the genetic changes that lead to the development of myeloma and how those changes ultimately affect how we think about the best treatment options for patients, and also it allows us to provide greater precision when it comes to the determination of outcomes and prognosis. Before I go into that, I'd like to make a couple of quick comments, and I understand some of this may be redundant to some, but when we talk about genetics, oftentimes one thinks about how we inherit things from one generation to the next, such as would be eye color or stature. What I'm going to be telling you about is more about the genetic changes that occur in a person's body, in that part of the body that develops the cancers. So in this case of myeloma, the genetic changes I will be discussing are the changes that occur in the myeloma cells, the plasma cells. So what we're seeing there and those changes that we see there are not changes that you would see in a person's body elsewhere. So if you take a sample from the skin or, you know, other parts of a person's body, we wouldn't see those genetic changes. So this is what we call acquired or somatic changes, not hereditary genetic factors. Now, what we have learned about this is that not all myelomas are the same. When we see a patient for the first time in the clinic, we try to determine, using some of these genetic tools, whether the person has some of the markers that would make that person fall into the category of high-risk disease. Now, this oftentimes creates confusion because there are many ways in which one can go about determining the risk status for a patient. But nowadays, it's safe to say that the most standardized format of doing this is through a laboratory technique we call FISH, which is a short acronym for the technique we use to determine a number of chromosome abnormalities that occur in the myeloma cells. Now, the simplest way to think about this, and of course there's many refinements and there's variations and permutations to what I'm going to say, but the simplest way to think about this is that there are three markers that determine the most common subcategory of high-risk disease, and that is patients who have a translocation between chromosomes 414, translocations between chromosomes 14 and 16, and deletions of chromosome 17. And of course, this will change, and I will discuss further how some of those specific markers have varied in their significance nowadays with the availability of the new treatments that we have for the treatment of the disease. Now, I did mention there's other ways in which a physician could determine whether the person has high-risk myeloma or not. Traditionally, or if you may, in the old ways, we used to do the karyotype analysis, so that's the classic chromosome analysis. And that was a time when if we found an abnormality we call chromosome 13 deletion, a patient was considered as having high-risk disease. An important comment should be made here. First of all, most centers do not do chromosome analysis anymore in this way, so this is what we used to call the karyotype. Second of all, a much greater number of patients can be seen as having chromosome 13 deletion when this abnormality is detected by FISH, and in and of itself, that does not imply that the person has high-risk myeloma. It is only when the person is detected as having chromosome 13 via this karyotype analysis. At the Mayo Clinic, we use predominantly the FISH analysis that I mentioned, again, the T414, 14, 16, and minus 17. And I consider them sort of cardinal sins. So if a person has any one of those abnormalities, irrespective of anything else, we would classify that patient as having high-risk multiple myeloma. Now, other ways of doing this, and we have participated in such efforts, is to use newer techniques, such as could be the gene expression profiling. And then as we move into the future, that no doubt will include tools such as genomic sequencing. Now, many of you know that we use a strategy that we call the MSMART, which is a consensus approach to make recommendations regarding risk stratification. And that has evolved over time as to how we place some of these markers. I think the details may be beyond this discussion, but if you're interested and you want to go and see what we say, go to msmart.org, where a consensus recommendation is made by all Mayo Clinic hematologists who deal with multiple myeloma, whereas we say for a patient who has a given abnormality, everything else being the same, what would you consider for treatment? Now, in our mind, this is critical information because as we meet with patients who have a recent diagnosis of myeloma and we're planning for their treatment, knowledge of this risk becomes paramount in that planning. First of all, if one has high-risk disease, our frequency of testing or monitoring may be different. The nature of the discussion and the expectations for outcomes certainly have to be different. But perhaps most importantly, the selection of treatment, previously only in the front line, now more so in the maintenance treatment, are modulated by whether a person has high-risk myeloma or not. As many of you know, some of the risk factors are working their way into other categories of the disease. So, for instance, for asymptomatic myeloma, there appears to be a higher propensity for progression if someone has one of these high-risk markers. So that patient may be followed on a more frequent basis as opposed to a patient who has none of these features. Now, I know we have very savvy members in the audience who know very well the myeloma literature and are constantly reading the studies that are coming out. And I put a word of caution regarding high-risk disease in the setting of myeloma beyond new diagnosis, so in the setting of relapse and refractory disease. And that goes as follows. First of all, high-risk markers are predominantly validated in individuals who have a new diagnosis. The clinical utility of risk stratification is lessened in a person who, for instance, has received four or five different treatments previously. And it just stands to reason that if you do have a person who, for instance, has received four different treatments for their myeloma and comes again and it's being considered for a new clinical trial or a new treatment option, and that person has one of the traditional high-risk markers, in and of itself, that tells you that that person has a marker that has not shown to be as predictive as a person who's unfortunately unable to get to that stage in the treatment course. So that's very important. The second one is you will frequently see in presentations at our scientific meetings and also in publications words such as X, Y, or Z treatment has been able to overcome high-risk markers. There's quite a bit of statistical aspects of how one needs to go about to actually say that you should overcome or you can overcome some of these markers. And in fact, I always say to people, just be cautious about that because it is more difficult to interpret high-risk markers in the setting of relapse and refractory myeloma. Now, with all of what we have been said, a natural question would be, how is it that any of these markers make a myeloma more high-risk? And what do we mean by high-risk? Well, by high-risk, we mean a myeloma that is more likely to relapse shortly after therapy is terminated or with a shorter duration of a response after initial therapy. And also, it's a myeloma that is more likely to become resistant or refractory to the various treatment options that are available. Now, how does this happen? Well, we know now, and perhaps the most important aspect of a myeloma being refractory, being high risk, is that the myeloma can adapt. We'll talk about this further in the panel session, but many of you know that even when each one of the myelomas is different, if you start drilling down and then you start asking, how are the individual cells of a myeloma patient similar or different from one another, we know that they're not all the same. They are all related, but they have subtle differences. And the point is that the more diversity there is in those differences, the more likely it is that some of those cells will be able to overcome the therapeutic effect of, say, something like lenalidomide or bortezomib. So it all really goes down to diversity and ability to adapt. This is what allows myeloma cells who are designated as having high-risk ability to bypass the effect of some of our treatments. In fact, it may be that in the future, we might not even be measuring any of those genetic markers, but instead we might be measuring, in the various ways that are being developed, the ability of myeloma cells to adapt to challenges. Because at the end of the day, that is what defines high-risk myeloma. And that is what, unfortunately, makes this more challenging to be treated in the clinic. Now, to finish on a positive note, I think the way we try to think about high-risk myelomas, yes, at the time of diagnosis, it poses greater challenges and the risk for the treatments not being optimal is greater. However, there's multiple exceptions for high-risk myelomas such that we try to provide the best treatment available for the patient, but don't necessarily think that the efforts that are being provided would be without benefit. In fact, we need more treatments. We need better therapeutic strategies for high-risk myeloma. But we treat patients with perhaps even greater intensity in the hope that we can make those patients fall into that exception category. And there's a number of efforts that are going on, such as combining currently available drugs with some of the drugs that are in clinical trials, perhaps combining some of the drugs we have with strategies such as are being developed in the realm of immunotherapy, or use strategies that exploit the normal biology of the cells that gave rise to the myeloma in the hopes that combining that with available treatments would allow us to overcome some of the challenges that are seen with the genetic makeup of high-risk multiple myeloma. I should share with the group that as a community, as a scientific community, development of effective therapeutic strategies for high-risk myeloma is the number one priority. Everything is cared for, and we have clinical trials going on for all myeloma patients, but everyone recognizes that bringing effective therapy for patients who have the designation of high-risk disease is our number one priority. So with that, I'm going to close my introductory remarks, and I think we'll go on to the panel session.
Okay. Well, Doctor, I've got a couple more things that I'd like to talk about just before
Sure.
we go on to the panel section. You mentioned the biology is basically that it is more the ability of myeloma cells to adapt. Is that correct? That was kind of my second leading question.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Now, Some local hematologists and oncologists either have tests for risk or in some cases never have tests to determine risk. So what, you know, what is the best plan for somebody who's newly diagnosed? How, what should they do, you know, with regard to this? Do you just leave it up to your local oncologist, or do you need to know what the difference is?
Well, you know, the risk of being self-serving, and I think you've discussed this in previous panels, I think it's a good idea to have at some point in the course of the disease of a patient to try to involve someone who has the focused expertise on the disease, just because the complexity is so great that if it's possible, even if it's just for a single consultation, it's a good idea to have someone else be your partner in the process of the treatment for the disease. Fully realize this is complicated because sometimes patients will be far away from some of the centers that focus on multiple myeloma, but I think it's a good idea. In the absence of that, I would recommend that patients discuss this with their providers. Now, this may be challenging because sometimes a person has learned about the importance of risk stratification only after they have received treatment already, and perhaps at the point where it may be impossible to tell whether a person has high-risk markers or not. That's a common consult we see. If you're in that category, I would tell you, I think while we would have liked to have that information up front, we'll normally keep in mind that we try to extrapolate from other clinical markers as well as from the clinical behavior whether the person has high-risk disease or not, and then try to modulate our treatment strategies accordingly. But if at all possible, it should be done in all patients. Now, the good news is these markers can be done through reference laboratories. So if a provider was interested in doing so, they could have their local laboratory submit a small sample from the bone marrow. And that sample can be tested at the number of central laboratories that can do the risk determination. Then that information will go back, of course, to the patient and to the physician. And as I mentioned during my introductory comments, we truly believe this is an essential component of expert care for multiple myeloma because of the implications it has for counseling, for prognosis, for treatment selection. And it's just such a core aspect of what we do in the care of patients.
Earlier, and it was something that I wasn't quite sure I understood, but you had said that it's important, more important, to find out about risk stratification and what the risk factor is at the very beginning. However, I had been under the assumption that all of us with treatment seem to go through changes in our disease and that it takes on more and more risks, you know, different chromosomal changes and becomes a higher risk. The biology of our myeloma, for example, tends to change and be more adaptive to treatments, just like you said, which creates a higher risk. And as a result, you know, we all go or will end up in some way in a higher risk mode. And as a result, doesn't testing also for risk then become important later in treatment?
Right. Well, you know, it's a bit of a nuanced aspect of the discussion we have with patients. There's certain markers that never change over the lifetime of a person and will never change in all of their myeloma cells. So an example of this is chromosome translocation, let's say, between chromosomes 4 and 14. If a person has a T414, they have had a T414 when the process was an MGUS or a smoldering myeloma. It is a T414, and it will be throughout the course of the disease, always T414. Now, there are other abnormalities, other secondary abnormalities, like, for instance, chromosome 17 deletion. Chromosome 17 deletion can change over time, and that's just an example of one of the many things that can change. So you might have a patient who, at the time of diagnosis, does not have chromosome 17 deletion, but yet you're able to detect that later in the course of the disease. Now, chromosome 17 is one of potentially many, if not thousands, of examples of things that could change over time. But for practical reasons, we focus on some of the most common and known markers for genetic evolution over time. And in fact, when we've done studies using next-generation sequencing and some FISH analysis, we know that there is always a possibility of acquisition of changes, genetic changes. And that's something we want to prevent. especially in the high-risk patients. We don't want the tumor to become more diverse and more able to adapt to the effects of treatment.
Okay. One question is risk factors seem to be changing. For example, deletion of chromosome 13 was once high-risk disease, but with the use of Velcade is no longer high-risk. This is important when trials are now being designed for high-risk patients, especially for smoldering multiple myeloma with eligibility criteria. Can you expect more advancements against high-risk disease also with the new drugs like Pomalyst and Kyprolis?
Sure. Well, that certainly is our hope. When we mean that something has overcome the effects of a risk marker, what we really are saying is that the treatment has become good enough that the actual set of markers that a person has seems to be less relevant than what it was in the past. Still, the myeloma is the same. The myeloma, this is an intrinsic aspect of myeloma. The myeloma has the same propensity to be mischievous and to try to get around the effects of treatment, but a given treatment is able to overcome this. So, you know, the case you mentioned of bortezomib is really important. In the old days, we used to say, well, maybe you should consider bortezomib earlier on in someone who has high-risk disease. I think currently the majority of patients will get a bortezomib-based regimen for the induction therapy, be that in the form of VRD, CyBorD, or one of the various regimens. So that issue is not as important right now. However, there's data that's coming out from multiple studies that suggest that if a patient has high-risk disease, bortezomib now should be introduced in the maintenance phase of treatment. Now, this is a more complex decision because, of course, the duration of that could be longer. The setting in which you provide that treatment is different than doing it so upfront. So I think the relative weight of that knowledge becomes greater. And in a case, like you say, in smoldering multiple myeloma, I think this is going to be even more relevant because now we're going into a scenario where a person is asymptomatic, and what we truly are trying to do is prevent the progression to more aggressive disease. I'm sure your audience is aware that such efforts have been done, for instance, with lenalidomide for patients with smoldering diseases was tested in the Spanish group. However, the question is there. If you have high-risk markers and you have smoldering multiple myeloma, should you be using bortezomib or, for that matter, any one of the other proteasome inhibitors as part of the core of your therapy? And the logical answer would be yes. But now you have to ask the question, well, the scenario is now it's a patient who's asymptomatic. Well, normally, we wouldn't think that requires treatment, and we're exposing them to a new class of agents. Those questions need to be addressed, and it's very important they are addressed in the context of clinical trials. I'd venture to say that in the absence of a clinical trial, no one here at Mayo would be proposing that we use proteasome inhibitors or the like in the setting of smoldering multiple myeloma.
Okay. Doctor, you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. What are the best treatments for high-risk disease currently, and what are the current clinical trials that you see that provide the most promise?
Okay, so for myeloma that has, you know, this high-risk features, it's very clear, as I was saying, that one has to think about the introduction of proteasome inhibitors early on, and proteasome inhibitors for a longer duration of treatment. So again, I'm going to use the algorithm that we have developed at MSmart, where we try to classify patients. For the sake of simplicity, just allow me to say that we classify patients into high risk and also intermediate risk. This is an evolving classification. It's something that will continue to change over time. But I'm gonna group them somewhat just to say the kind of treatments that we would provide for these patients. First of all, we would do induction treatment at our institution that is mostly done with a combination of the cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. And we can do this in traditionally it has been done for four cycles. I think a question would be, should we go for longer in someone who's responding? And I think that's a fair question. But traditionally what we would do is we treat patients with 4 months worth of CyBorD or similar. For the high-risk patients, we made a small variation where we substitute the cyclophosphamide for the lenalidomide. And the reason for that is that cyclophosphamide being a traditional chemotherapeutic agent, there's at least a hypothetical or a theoretical concern that it may induce further genetic instability. This is not known, but since VRD and CyberD are quite similar regimens, we have put that out in our M-SMART recommendations. And what has changed recently is that after the patient proceeds with autologous stem cell transplant, for those who are eligible for such a procedure, we have made emphasis on the need of some bortezomib post-transplant. And again, this is a huge thing because of the implications of having someone go back to treatment even after they have completed their stem cell transplant protocol. So that's what we do, and if the audience is interested in the details, again, I'll refer them to msmart.org.
Okay, and the clinical trials that you see that are promising?
Clinical trials that are promising, I think, first of all, the combination of IMiDs plus proteasome inhibitors needs to be tested further, and one of the questions is whether this should be done with or without stem cell transplant. Some of that is being addressed as a subset analysis for the ongoing clinical trials. I particularly like two approaches. One of them is to continue to exploit some of the normal plasma cell biology to see if we could use the mechanisms that already exist in the plasma cells to try to have them go through the cell death process, the apoptosis. And there's a number of drugs that are looking at things such as methylation, are looking at accumulation of immunoglobulins that might be of interest. But overall, our most interesting approach, I think, for high-risk disease is to try to go to parts of the cells that are less likely to be changing because of those genetic changes. One of those areas could be the cell surface. And the way we could go about doing this would be with some of the new monoclonal antibodies. I think the highest interest right now for combinations for the treatment of high-risk disease in the context of clinical trial may be to use optimal therapy such as, again, VRD or CyberD, and then combine them with something like a monoclonal antibody against CD38, where you bring the power of the cell killing that you have with those drugs, and then you augment that with the administration of the monoclonal antibodies. There could be other immune strategies. I think they're still somewhat early, have been developed for CLLs using the CAR-T and, vaccination. But right now, I think the monoclonal antibodies administered in conjunction with novel agents would be my number one choice for clinical trials for high-risk disease.
Well, thank you so much, Doctor. I really appreciate that. Now we'll go on to the panel questions, if you. What I'd like to do is just let everybody know that it's one question per panelist, and we'll go around for a second round after we open it up for calls from some of our callers. And prior to going into that, I'd like to take the opportunity at this point to welcome a brand new panelist, and that is Misty Callahan. Misty, could you just give us a little rundown of your background? And then you can ask your question first. You're going to be first up to bat.
Well, thank you so much. I got involved with, mostly myeloma got involved with me back in September of 2012. My mother was diagnosed, and she passed away by July of 2013. She had a very aggressive form of multiple myeloma. So this is, thank you, everybody, for doing this. So that's basically why I got involved with multiple myeloma to my mother. And what upset me the most, I guess, to seeing her daughter and just being a caregiver in that position was that there was very little known about multiple myeloma. I never really heard of it before she was diagnosed. So that caused me to get involved with the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation. I'm actually part of their young professionals group out here in Chicago. I spend most of my days doing traffic reporting. So, again, thank you guys for taking the time out to do this. It's very important and very personal to me on that note. To my question.
Not much traffic in Chicago, is there? Oops.
Yeah, it's a little snug out here usually. but my question is, Doctor, you did bring up stem cell transplantation, and not too long ago I was able to interview Dr. Todd Zimmerman over at the University of Chicago, who
sure.
who does a lot of stem cell transplantation. My question to you is, what factors would allow a high-risk patient to be eligible for stem cell transplantation? And on that note, how much success have you seen with high-risk patients and stem cell transplantation?
You know, thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for sharing your story and for being part of this panel. I know this disease has touched many of us in different ways, and I think your efforts and those of groups like this are so critical in bringing awareness of the disease to other individuals. I always say that if you go to a group and you ask people who's heard about leukemia, I think the whole room is going to raise their hand. And if you say who's heard about myeloma, you're lucky if a third of the room raises their hand. So I think the work you do, and you do so as a panel member, I think is just outstanding. Going to your question, the high risk in and of itself is not a contraindication for transplant. What we know though is that if we do transplant in patients who have high risk disease, and we just expect that alone to be sufficient, is really not going to be a very smart thing to do. It's a bit of a Pyrrhic victory. Because we know patients who have high-risk markers, there's a great likelihood that the majority of them will show evidence of disease relapse within a year after transplant. So our group and others have considered that this is really not a good return on investment when you think about the time, the toxicity, and everything that a patient has to go through transplant. I would say the same criteria applies for high risk as it applies for any other patient, being that the person is healthy and they have, you know, a good physical condition, even more so than their age, so that they're good candidates for the stem cell procedure. But what will change is how we think about what we do before and what we may do after the transplant for patients with multiple myeloma. And you obviously shared the story of your mom, and, you know, it was obviously a very short time from the time she was diagnosed and unfortunately until the time she passed away. And I should make a comment. I don't know the specifics about your mom, but there's many other factors that will determine the likelihood that the myeloma will be a very serious condition. All of what I have talked about is a very small fraction of the whole experience and the whole process of having to deal with this terrible disease, which is just the biology and the genetics of the disease. You know, if a person has complications from the myeloma, such as would be the renal failure, they have other medical problems, or they come with debility, all of those may be as important, if not sometimes even more important, than the biology of the disease in determining whether one can be successful with the treatment of it or not. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Okay. Well, and again, welcome, Misty. We appreciate your contribution. We're so sorry to hear about your mama. But I will tell you that one thing that I've found is that most of the people who do get multiple myeloma, generally they're not quite as computer literate, shall we say. You know, they tend to be older, and as a result, their children and those people who are younger tend to take the leadership role in finding out what's going on with the disease, and certainly I know my daughter, who happens to be with the Wall Street Journal, she did a lot of the research for me early on in this whole process. So we thank God for our kids. So thank you so much. Jack, are you there? Jack, your question? Okay, Jack, we'll catch up to you then. Nick Van Dyke, you on the line?
I am here. Can you hear me?
You bet. Hi, Nick.
How are you?
Good.
You're making me choose between my two beloved children with these questions, but there is one in particular that Dr. Fonseca is uniquely suited for, so I'm going to go with that. And as usual, I'm going to preface my question with an apology for its length, but I think there's a bit of context that could be useful here. I should also say that I'm a graduate of Total Therapy from about 5 years ago, so that informs a bit of my perspective. Doctor, you mentioned there are a number of different methods of testing for high-risk disease, which include FISH, and Arkansas uses gene array, and there are others. And it's obviously constantly changing based on the effectiveness of novel agents. But one thing that I think you see across some of these schemes is the role of the MYC gene that has a big role in causing some genetic mutations. And I actually looked into this at one point in my own therapy because my MCPheen was off the charts at diagnosis, and it was so much off the charts that my Dr. Barlaby wanted to Velcade into a fifth year of maintenance, despite the fact that I was in complete remission, but he eventually relented. And both he and Dr. Anderson at Dana-Farber suggested that I speak with you about the role of the MYC gene, and then eventually Barlaby was happy with my bone marrow, so I didn't need to. But that being said, as you are a world-renowned expert on this, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about the role this particular gene plays in these genetic mutations, what therapies are effective against it, and whether or not once it's been normalized, it can stay that way.
Sure. Well, thank you again. Thank you for sharing it, and of course, delighted to know that the your results are so good. And just for the rest of the audience, MYC gene is it's a very interesting gene. It turns out that most of the cancer genes, or most of the genes that we don't like when they act on cancer, they were actually essential and very important when, for instance, a baby is being formed, a fetus is being formed, as we grow limbs, as we grow through life. Most of the genes that ultimately become cancer genes were growing genes, and are genes that are just fundamental for body functions. It's just that the context in which they become abnormal becomes so problematic, and I think MYC is a great example of this. 30 years ago, MYC was thought to be very important in myeloma because, you know, the models that were available at the time show that actually mice who were overexpressing MYC had a high propensity for myeloma. But then everything was abandoned because people thought, well, this really does not represent myeloma. This is a very artificial model. And then we started asking the question and doing genetic analysis with some of our older tools, if you may, and really no one found much in the way of MYC being abnormal in myeloma. So it really became sort of a story where we thought, you know, we thought we were smart, MYC was not involved, we thought MYC was involved, now we know it's not, let's forget about MYC. Well, subsequently, better techniques came along, such as, you say, gene expression profiling, and perhaps most recently, next-generation sequencing, where we have found that, in fact, MYC is very important in up to 50% of patients. Now, how could that be? Well, it turns out that the MYC abnormalities are very small abnormalities, abnormalities that would normally be hidden to standard genetic testing, and it's only because of this sophisticated ability of sequencing that we can now detect them in patients. At this point, the prognostic implication for MYC has not been fully tested, and part of this is that the way to go about determining whether someone has a MYC elevation or not, or a MYC abnormality or not, is not that simple. Number two is MYC could be very important even if it's expressed at a relatively low level. And by that I mean you can have a gene that is just changed a little bit in the level or it's in concentration inside the cell, and that can have dramatic influences in how those cells behave, and I think MYC is one of those examples. It turns out that MYC appears to be perhaps more important in about one-half of myeloma patients with a certain skewing towards the non-high-risk population. Now, there are some patients who have high risk and will have very high levels of MYC, but the good news, if there's any, when one talks about the disease, of course, is that MYC seems to be more common with a standard and lower risk when it comes down to the abnormality. My colleague here, Leif Bergsago, has done quite a bit of work on this, and it turns out that there are associations, very significant associations, between MYC and what we call the hyperdiploid variant of myeloma, which is not the high-risk disease. I know our friend and colleague also Nikhil Munshi, the Dana-Farber, has published recent data regarding MYC and association with hyperdiploid category. And so we know that. We don't know 100% what it means if you were to detect this in the clinic, and mostly because we don't have agreed upon tools that we would use for determination of MYC as a prognostic marker. But one potential silver lining is that we are now getting drugs that can target MYC, and there's a number of them that have been recently developed. This is quite a development because MYC is important not only for myeloma, but for many other cancers. It's one of those genes that seems to be important in many of the common human cancers. And if we had a way that we could affect the ability of MYC to behave as a cancer gene, I think this would be important for many, many cancers. Specifically, these are called the BET, the bromodomain inhibitors. I think that in and of itself could be the subject of a full-hour discussion or more. That those clinical trials are in early phase right now, but I think some of the trials that have the greatest attention right now from our community, and you know, things like JQ1 are of great interest to researchers. I hope that answers the question too.
Yeah, thank you. I'll hold my tongue on my second question, but if there's time, I'd love to ask it later.
All right, second round. Cindy, are you there?
Gary, Jack is with us.
Oh, okay, Jack.
Yeah.
I think I kind of stepped on your question, and I apologize for that. So if you'd like
That's okay. Let's first make sure you can hear me. Is that okay now?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, I heard you last time as well, but you couldn't then.
Okay.
So I want to ask questions, and Dr. Fonseca, we really appreciate your being on this call. You've always, and you alluded to the fact that these myeloma proteins can change over time. They become clones that may have different properties as we go along. So I'm wondering, let's take your M-SMART example. When patients are categorized into the different risk categories, and then they'll get their auto transplants, will you do another FISH analysis? And so maybe that you'll find a standard risk patient migrates to high risk and gets a different maintenance treatment than they were originally planning on, or vice versa? The cytogenetics testing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. For the most part, we make the decisions about treatment after stem cell transplant before the transplant itself. And the reason for that is it becomes very hard to determine risk stratification after the transplant. So, you know, when we meet with patients at that usual day 100 visit, so 3 months out from their stem cell transplant, the reality is, and it's a very fortunate reality, the majority of patients will have no significant amount of plasma cells or no plasma cells that can be detected and come to us with a complete response. So trying to do that determination at that time would be nearly impossible, at least for, you know, 80-90% of patients. So we can't do that. I guess the good news is we think at that point there's a good likelihood that the makeup of the myeloma hasn't changed that much, so we can probably use the information that we have from up front. But if you take that question further and you say, okay, let's look at this a year out or maybe 5 years out when I'm contemplating the next line of therapy, well, I think that's a question that really has no objective data to be supported one way or another, but we do that as academic institutions. We don't necessarily repeat the FISH for the main markers, but, you know, one could consider repeating the FISH, say, for, you know, the 17p, chromosome 1 abnormalities, MYC abnormalities, and, again, we continue to learn about the implications of all of this. We don't have the answers to all of those. Certainly, if we apply deeper genomic tools such as next-generation sequencing, we always find things, and we always find things that are slightly different. And the biggest challenge we have right now is how do we move this from being a concept to perhaps make it important for the individual decision-making for the patient? I think right now it's more of a conceptual process that we know that things may change and that may make us think in one way or another. But you know what they say, it just takes a dumb tumor to outsmart the smartest oncologist. And that's what we really find, that myeloma is so diverse that trying to make predictions based on that information remains a big challenge. And I should have mentioned earlier on that even though we try to categorize myeloma into buckets, into, let's say, the biggest bucket being high risk versus not, we know once we start drilling down that every single myeloma is slightly different. And even within that myeloma, you know, we talked briefly about the subclones, there will be subpopulations of cells that are different from each other. So that really has fundamentally changed how we think about the approach for treatment for patients.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Cindy?
Jerry, Cindy's not with us today.
Oh,
she
that's
to
right. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you mentioned
minute.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lizzie.
We have
Pat
and Lizzie. Yeah.
I was looking forward to talk to Cindy because she and I exchanged electronic communication. So I'll send her my regards electronically.
Okay.
She had an emergency, Lizzie, and had to cancel at the last minute.
Yeah,
okay.
I remember you.
And I know Lizzie as well, too, of course. So I'm looking forward to her question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi. Well, it's a pleasure speaking with you again. My question is, when it comes to maintenance therapy for someone that had been or that was a high-risk patient, I mean, just to bring up my own example, I was a high-risk patient. I responded really well to therapy. It's been a year and a half post two stem cell transplants, and there's no indication that those same risk factors are still there, so which is good news, knock on wood. So how would you approach the maintenance therapy stage? For how long, and what would you recommend?
Sure. I don't know if you would be willing, or if you could also, to share a little bit more of what you mean by the high risk, and do you know the specific markers?
I had a 17 deletion.
Okay.
So.
You know, thank you. Thank you for doing that. If the approach we're taking now, and I think that probably would be more at the time of just the stem cell transplant completion, has been that for the majority of patients who have a 17p deletion, we would go on to some form of a combinatorial strategy, usually with the bortezomib plus lenalidomide. The dosing of that becomes important because one can not usually use the same doses as you use in the upfront setting, so one has to go with lower doses of the medication because, after all, you know, the bone marrow is still recovering and it's, you know, forming the cells it needs to form, but it's still it's a somewhat fragile environment. We would also add to that, but with varying doses, and a lot of this is very empirical, some dexamethasone, and the duration of that is unknown. So many of us would try to think about 1 to 2 years worth of therapy. And, of course, you know, you have to take into consideration whether the person has received the treatment before, in particular with a bortezomib, whether they have had problems with peripheral neuropathy or not. I think that would be really important in determining whether you could use that further or not. My real hope is that for a situation like yours, you just described, that we're going to move at some point in the future to proteasome inhibitors that come in the pill form. So then we can have the benefit of the convenience plus the effect of proteasome inhibitors in the post-transplant setting. While this is not universally agreed by the myeloma community, I personally believe that using lenalidomide alone in high risk as maintenance is probably not optimal. And in fact, there is some data from our colleagues in the UK that using lenalidomide in that scenario may even be harmful. This needs to be confirmed. But the way we approach this, if we're going to go with a maintenance strategy in someone who has high-risk markers, we would usually go with a combination of both bortezomib and lenalidomide.
And is there a maximum duration that you would kind of go with? I've heard,
you know,
2 years maximum, others forever maybe.
I think everyone lives somewhere between those two extremes, 2 years to indefinite. And I know that's a bad way to answer your questions because ideally we would have more data. I have to say that most of the data that's coming out from not only myeloma but multiple other tumors that have similar features to myeloma, including things such as breast cancer, I know lung cancer is quite different, that it appears that duration of therapy matters and it may be to the advantage of a person. Of course, for as long as the treatment is well-tolerated and it's not causing too much in the way of toxicity, to think about longer duration of therapy. So I am one who sits more in the camp of thinking for longer duration of therapy as opposed to shorter. And the same would be true for lenalidomide. For instance, lenalidomide maintenance, which, you know, we discuss with essentially all of our patients, we would say that you know, there's more of the French or European approach to think about a limited duration of therapy versus I tend to go with indefinite therapy in that setting. And I'm fully realize this has all sorts of implications as far as toxicity, the duration of therapy, cost, etc. But just for medical reasons alone, I try to think about longer duration of therapy for that setting. Now, you probably have heard in this radio show that there's persons who have been on things such as lenalidomide for years. I think I have a patient who's probably close to 10 years, and there's probably people out there with longer duration of lenalidomide. I've seen a patient, and of all people, from Vincent Rajkumar in Rochester, my good friend and colleague, who had been on 8 years duration of bortezomib, which is probably the longest I've seen for a bortezomib administration.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
it. Okay, Pat Killingsworth, are you online?
Thanks, Gary. I thought you'd forgotten about me. I'll try not to take it personally.
Never could do that. I understand, but you're going to have a great one tomorrow, right? You have your own cure panel tomorrow on marijuana, I understand.
That's right. That Dr. Abrams out of California. It should be interesting.
I call it Pat's Pot Party. All right, Pat, your question.
Thanks, Doctor. I know a number of high-risk patients that have responded very well to normal therapy, and some of them for a number of years, 3, 4, 5 years. I with my blogging and as a columnist for the Myeloma Beacon, I hear from a number of patients from all around the world, actually. But then, sometimes, when these patients relapse...
I can go pick up Morgan.
Who's talking out there?
Who has to pick up Morgan? Take us off your speakerphone.
Anyway, sometimes when these patients relapse, I notice they relapse very fast and very hard, sometimes not recovering, where a low or moderate-risk patient might have 3, 4, 5, 6 relapses. Can you explain why that happens, why some of these patients do so well for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then it's almost like somebody flips a switch and all of a sudden they're in real trouble?
Yes. Well, thank you for the question. I think for audience, the main difference between high-risk and standard-risk myeloma is not the ability to respond. The ability to respond is very similar. There's a slight difference, but it's usually very similar. The difference comes in the duration of that response. And the biggest difference is that high-risk myeloma tends to have recurrence that occurs at an earlier time than patients who have standard-risk. And also when it occurs, it has usually more aggressive features than the standard risk patient who may recur a few years down the line. And the explanation for that is that the rate of growth of those cells and the rate of adaptability of those cells seems to be greater with high risk, such that even though you see that go away, once you stop therapy, the cells regroup and they'll come back and they'll display some of those features of rapid growth and you know the ability to evade treatment. And that's why in and of itself it becomes somewhat tricky to talk about response and what does that mean for long-term outcome, because some of the patients who might do the best, they have responses that we may not be satisfied with, responses that may mean that the person has a very good partial response or keeps a monoclonal protein after transplant. But it turns out that those proteins can be there for a very long period of time. And it may be that some of the cells that are left behind look more like MGO cells as opposed to true myeloma cells. Whereas with the high risk, you have this unfortunate situation where there's a perception that all of the cells have been killed, and yet the cells still remain in the background, regroup, and then will start growing when therapy started. And this is one of the principles upon which we have advocated on the idea of keeping pressure on those cells and those clones with continued therapy for high-risk myeloma patients.
Very helpful. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
And thank you, Pat. Doctor, we're running a little bit over. Do you have any extra time after the 60 minutes, or... Do we need to cut it
sure.
off at that point? Okay.
No, I'm
I just wondered if I should, you know, yeah. Because now it's time for our caller comments, and we only have a few minutes left, so if we can run over a little bit, that would be great. So at this point, if anybody has a question, and actually we've got a number of them, and I'd love for people to press 1 on your keypad, and we'll bring you on with your question. And we'd prefer to have all of you ask your own question. And so please, and now that we have a little bit of extra time, hopefully we can get to a few of those questions. So please press 1 on your keypad, and Priya will bring you online with your question.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you very much. I have my colleague with you who will bring you on air to ask your question live. Shweta, if we have callers online, please bring them on air.
Yeah, sure. Priya, thank you. We have a caller from 305-294-6240. You are on air. Please ask your question.
Yes, I was recently diagnosed with multiple myeloma in September. And I'm a veteran. I went to the Veterans Administration, and they've been telling me they wanted to start me on a low dose of Revlin, I guess, and then once a week, the 40 milligrams of steroids. And I'm just wondering if I'm going down a road I've never been on before. I don't know where there's any potholes and things of that nature. And I just wondered if this is the route that a person should take.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing. I presume the 305, you probably are going to the VA hospital in Miami.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And this is one of the standard treatments that you know, would be given to patients. As you know, 40 milligrams is a standard dose of the dexamethasone. And to your question, will there be potholes of, you know, there's obviously a possibility of some side effects. It turns out that some of the hardest things that we see, and myself not being a patient, I'll admit, is the effects of the dexamethasone, that the effects that it may have on a person losing sleep, and some of the things that naturally occur with things like this, as could be mood swings. I think one important question that I would have for your provider, and you can discuss that personally with them, of course, too, is what is sort of the long-term plan? I think that's an important question for anyone who's embarking on therapy for myeloma. You want to ask your provider, okay, this is what we're doing now, but what are we looking long-term? Because I think that will dictate a lot of how we think about the various medications and where to introduce them, doses, duration, et cetera.
Okay.
Also, do you know whether you're high or low risk? That would be a good question, wouldn't it, doctor?
Yes, please.
No, I don't know. I don't know that. What happened is they've been doing the blood work, and my blood work looks good, and my kidneys are, and urine is clear, and my kidneys are functioning fine. But the last blood work that I did, I start having a spike in protein and a drop in hemoglobin.
Okay, you might ask them for a fish test, I would think, right, doctor?
Yeah, and you said you're in Miami, right? The VA hospital in Miami.
Well, I live in Key West, but I have to go up there. To get
you go
treatment.
Up to Miami. Yeah, they have some people there who are very knowledgeable in this. That, you know, and as you know, they work together with the program at the University of Miami. But I would ask them for risk, and also I would ask them for the discussion on the long-term plan.
Did you say risk test, R-I-S-K?
The risk stratification for the fish test that we were discussing, yes.
The fish? I didn't get to – I had a hard time getting onto
fish,
the program,
yeah.
So I
yeah,
missed
Yeah, fish,
that.
You're right, the fish analysis.
Okay, the fish test?
Correct.
Okay, I will do that. I'm going to go up there, I believe, tomorrow, and I will ask that fish test and the long-term.
Yes. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for the pathway you've taken in life to help people in my position. I appreciate it very much, sir.
Well, I appreciate it and wish you the best, too.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay, Priya, next question.
Do we have another call?
I think we have... we have. That's all we have for now. I think we can go for the second round of questions from the panelists.
Well,
yes.
Okay.
Gary,
well,
maybe we could go with the questions.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Should we go, Priya, should we go to the other questions from our callers?
Yes, I think that would be good. We've got a long list of questions.
Yes, we do.
So maybe we could go over those.
Yes. We have a question here. What maintenance therapy would you, doctor, suggest for a patient with the following situation? Auto stem cell transplant 9 months ago using 200 milligrams of melphalan. Stringent complete response before and after transplant. Standard risk profile. Blood counts very slow to recover. Platelets are now, after 9 months, at 47.
You know, this is a situation I probably would have to know more details, but it's a situation where I would have the discussion with the patient, particularly their standard risk about lenalidomide. The challenge there will be the low platelets. I presume there might be some challenges as well, too, with the white count, which may be on the lower side. There's some reason to believe that even for patients who have very deep responses, they might benefit from maintenance therapy. It's a bit of a nuanced discussion, but that would be my short answer. I would discuss lenalidomide maintenance with that particular patient.
Okay, fantastic. Would you, doctor, consider maintenance therapy of lenalidomide 28-day cycle starting at 2.5 all the way to 10 milligrams. Where would you suggest?
You know, I usually like to start more with a 10 milligram dosage for this. I mean, there's even the question whether some patients should be getting dexamethasone as well, too. But I tend to go more with, as long as well the patient tolerates, with intensity of such a combination, and then adjust if needed down the line. Obviously, one has to consider the blood counts, just as we were discussing with the previous situation, as well as renal function in determining that dose.
Okay. We have one here. It's if someone, and this is sad, they're only 38 years old, if someone is dual refractory, high risk, only 38 years old, and is allo the next step after only having a partial response to a stem cell transplant, or is carfilzomib, pomalidomide, dex considered a better option? Additionally, are immune therapy drugs such as elotuzumab or daratumumab, or even an even better idea for high-risk patients?
Sure. I think obviously it's a situation that is complex. One would in general think that some of the combinations, I probably would go with a combination of carfilzomib, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone. But I'll be the first one to admit that in this very early age population, the use of allo is a question that frequently comes up. You will find a huge sort of difference in opinion depending on whether the person participates, he or her, as part of an allo team, with them having more experience and perhaps thinking more of this as an appropriate therapy. Whereas I would say a significant portion of the myeloma doctors are not necessarily enamored of the idea of allogeneic because, one, the availability of other treatments, and two, is the risk that it's included in doing an allogeneic stem cell transplant. Now, a lot of those things have improved. Risk is less. But still, if one gets into a complicated situation with allo, it could be not a good thing. Clinical trials have not really shown great benefit for allo transplant for high-risk disease. So as a group, we really have not recommended that outside of a clinical trial. But again, I'll say that there's other individuals who will consider this important. I do think that participating in clinical trials in this particular scenario would be important, particularly against the CD38. I think we're seeing that in other tumors, whereas early adopters, say, for immunotherapy for melanoma, and we're now know with a PD-1, PD-L1, things such as, you know, colon cancer, lung cancer, et cetera. So we're seeing a lot of benefit with immunotherapy in other settings, and I'd be inclined to look for a clinical trial along those lines.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Doctor. Another question. I'm almost 5 months post auto transplant and having to switch my meds over to Kyprolis and dexamethasone, Pomalyst, due to large skull plasmatomas and elevated proteins. I'm curious if you'd found that there is a better sequencing of drug regimens for high risk. In other words, do patients do better following a specific order of drug changes? Does one specific regimen have more success after another specific regimen?
Yeah, no, the short answer is we don't know. There's very little in the way of sequencing trials, looking at the pace of introduction of this agent. Our usual rule of thumb, which is largely empirical, is that we use an agent different from the last category that was used. But the answer is no. We don't really know. And this is a scenario, again, where medications such as Kyprolis, the carfilzomib, or pomalidomide, the Pomalyst, could be useful and either alone or, it sounds like in this case, in combination.
Okay. Well, what is the role of autologous stem cell transplant, single, two, tandem, or none, for high-risk patients?
Yeah, I think the current standard is that it is an option for patients. We do single transplants. I think most institutions do. Very few are doing the tandem. There is a thought that perhaps we should be looking at non-transplant options for high risk. I was at a symposium this past weekend where Dr. Barlogi himself was saying that he would reconsider stem cell transplant for high-risk multiple myeloma, given the, again, relatively limited return on investment. But a lot of this is an academic discussion. I would say the short answer for someone who's out there right now would be that we do consider stem cell transplant, a single one, and part of the standard of care for patients who are eligible for such treatment.
And with these stem cell transplants, are the outcomes better for like 414 deletion, deletion of 17, 1416? You know, are there better outcomes given different chromosomal abnormalities?
Sure. The implications would be the same as when we were discussing high risk. We know that in the absence of maintenance strategies, any one of those markers for high-risk disease would be the patient at significant risk for relapse a year after the transplant. So that's why it's so important that we have that risk classification.
Okay. When we look online, the prognosis for survival is pretty scary for high-risk myeloma. I've seen many that say medium survival for us is about 29 months. Have you found this to be accurate given some of the newer drugs? Have you seen changes in the numbers and what are the numbers in Mayo?
We have seen changes, but unfortunately the improved survival that we have seen in myeloma is mostly because of the better changes that are seen in patients with standard risk disease and not in high risk disease. I think we clearly know that patients with high-risk myeloma do better because of the availability of the new drugs, but there's not very detailed analysis. I would say that it's really hard to interpret numbers. I think when one thinks about 29 months, as you know, that may mean a median, and that really only tells us that the disease has been serious enough that for half of those patients, the disease would be a life-ending event at the end of 29 months. But we know there's also the other side of the curve where there's patients who are going to have much longer duration of therapy. So I would urge the audience, and I'm sure you've discussed this before, never to take that as a set amount of time that a person has, and I wouldn't necessarily even use the 29 months. I'm quite certain that with some of the treatments that we have, the numbers should be better, but that's getting a very precise number is going to be hard, only because high risk represents a small fraction of all myeloma.
Okay. I have one question here, which is quite interesting. It's with all the talk about monoclonal antibodies, daratumumab received breakthrough status from the FDA in May of 2013, nearly a year ago. Despite this, there are only two clinical trials listed on the national clinical trials for using daratumumab with lenalidomide and dex. One of these trials, NCT-01621-5029, is only offered at a single location in the United States. In contrast, the same trial is offered at many foreign locations. The second trial, NCT-02076009, which is a phase 3 trial comparing daratumumab plus Lendex to Lendex, is offered in many foreign locations, including Poland, Russia, and Taiwan, but not in the United States. When will trials combining daratumumab with Lendex for relapse refractory multiple myeloma be more broadly available in the USA? What can the myeloma community do to expedite this? It's a great question.
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. I can tell you that there's such promise in daratumumab that I cannot think of any other drug that is being discussed more actively right now to be brought into the United States. So I think the question from the caller is right. We really don't have the full access that we would want to have for something like this yet. But I do anticipate and know for a fact that there's several more clinical trials coming down the line. It's hard to know. It's hard to predict right now where this would fall as far as being available through standard commercial routes. But if this reaches a point, at some point, that the drug is clearly something that is helping patients, the continued support from the community becomes very important. There's been previous instances where drugs like this have been made available through expanded access programs. I think the most notable one was when lenalidomide Revlimid became available through the Expanded Access Program, where very quickly, before we had the large clinical trials, essentially thousands of patients went on treatment with lenalidomide. So I think the short answer is people are working very hard. These trials are being developed. Some of them are going to be open. They will not necessarily they won't necessarily provide all the spots that are necessary for the treatment of all patients. But I do anticipate and hope that this will be available in a broader fashion, whether it's commercially approved or not, in a not so distant future.
Okay. Well, doctors, thank you so much. We've already run over 9 minutes on the program, so we do appreciate you doing that for us. Priya, I think maybe it's time for us to
thank
wrap
you,
up.
Thank you, Gary. Yeah, Dr. Fonseca, thank you so very much for being part of the show today and staying with us for the extra minutes. And the panelists, Gary, Jack, Nick, Pat, Misty, and Lucy, thank you so very much. Please join us again tomorrow at the same time. We have Pat Killingsworth discussing cannabis for cancer with Dr. Donald Abrahams of UCSF. Next week, we have two shows on myeloma. On 21st April at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we have myeloma survivors Jim and Kathleen Bond share their myeloma story with us on our myeloma support group meeting. And on 23rd April, we have Gary Peterson talk to Dr. Philip McCarthy of Roseville Cancer Institute. For details and for registering, please visit curepanel.carefeed.in. And you can always mail me, priya@trilex.com. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you,
thank
doctor.
You everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
doctor. Welcome aboard, Misty.
Bye.